Turning to the second chapter of Chabaouk, after Yahweh rebukes the founder of Christianity on many different grounds for many different reasons, he reaffirms that he's not going to change, which is negates the essence of Pauline doctrine, that the Torah has been annulled, that it has been cast aside, that Yahweh has a change, new and different plan of salvation. One that's not based upon the requirements of the old covenant, because there's a new covenant without any requirements. But Yahweh says here, upon my requirements and responsibilities, I have decided I will literally and continually stand. And I will choose to always stand and present myself upon that which protects and fortifies. Now, there's two things here, which is, first, there are five conditions or requirements for participating in the covenant. God's going to say, I'm not changing those. You know, if you're a Christian, you believe that I've changed them, sorry, you're wrong. Conditions, requirements for participating in the covenant are not going to change. And then there are responsibilities that Yahweh has, and that is to fulfill Pesach, Matzah, Bikurim, and Shavuah, and ultimately to fulfill Teruah, Kippurim, and Sukkah. Then he says, I'm going to stand up and honor my responsibilities. I'm going to do what I have promised. I've decided that I will take my stand. He stood up for us on Pesach. He stood in for us on Matzah, so that we could stand with him on Bikurim and Shavuah. That's the whole purpose of this. And yet, Pauline doctrine and Christianity, therefore, annul all of it. And God's saying, don't buy into it. This is the same sentiment that is being expressed by Yahusha in the Sermon on the Mount. He says, don't think that I came to annul the Torah of the prophets. I came to fulfill it. To honor my responsibility is what he's saying. Upon my requirements and responsibilities, I have decided I will literally and continuously stand, and I will choose to always stand and present myself upon that which protects and fortifies. So then, as a result, I will be on the lookout for. I will be on the lookout in order to see that which he, singular, masculine, will say about me. What one individual is going to say about me. Knowing that I'm not going to change, that the requirements of the covenant remain intact, and my responsibilities in terms of my role in protecting you through the mikra are going to be honored. So then, I'm going to be on the lookout. I'm going to see what he's going to say about me. But then, how can I be expected to change my attitude, my thinking, or my response concerning my disapproving rebuke? Since Paul negated everything that God said, why are Christians somehow perplexed that God hates their goddamn religion? Why are Christians somehow baffled that their New Testament, which contradicts the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, is displeasing to God, that God's going to rebuke it and them, as well as the founder of their religion, Paul. But you know what's interesting here? God's not saying you have to obey me. He's most certainly saying you don't need to fear me. What he is saying is, I reveal the truth to you. I revealed that I'm making you an offer, and I'm revealing that I am myself going to take a stand to fulfill my responsibilities, to honor the benefits of that offer. And I'm telling you that you can trust me in that regard. I'm not going to change. I've talked the talk. I've walked the walk. And then he says, so when somebody claims to speak for me, and renounces everything that I've said and comes up with an entirely different plan, you need to know that I'm going to disapprove him. I'm going to disapprove of that revision. No obey. Free will. You have a choice, but you know where God stands. Then Yahweh answered. Does it say then Allah answered? No. Does it say then Jesus answered? No. Does it say and then Christ answered? No. Does it say then Shiva answered? No. Does it say then the President of the United States answered? No. Then Yahweh answered, approaching me. And he said, write this revelation, and then expound upon and reiterate it using those letters upon writing tablets. By reciting this, he might run and go away. Now, here is Yahweh saying to his prophet, I want you to write this down. Now, it's interesting. We've been talking about the Quran's 8th surah, which was just, you know, it's mind-bogglingly repulsive. It was all verbal. There wasn't even a written language to write it down at the time it was recited. Verbal only. Now, it doesn't deal that way. Write it down. Why? If you write it down, it's etched in stone. It's not going to change. There's no erasers. You can depend upon that which is written. It will endure throughout time. Other people can read it. It will serve to convey the same message to people no matter what time or age they read those letters. Then Yahweh answered, approaching me, and he said, write this revelation, this communication down, and expound on it using those letters, teaching others its significance by plainly and clearly declaring it using large and distinct alphabetic characters. Upon writing tablets, engraving it in stone, so that by reciting this he might run and go away. You want to put Christianity on the run? You want to flee the evil that exists by corrupting Yahweh's testimony? Expound upon and reiterate his message through the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. It's the most effective tool that you can wield in this regard. Still indeed, this revelation from God is for the Moed, the appointed meeting times. It provides a witness to and speaks, pouring out evidence in the end. The extended period of time required for this question to be resolved shall not prove it false. Expect him, singular, masculine, in this regard, because indeed he will absolutely come, neither being delayed nor lingering. This revelation was revealed precisely 666 years before Paul would come forward and pen his first letter, that of the Galatians. That's a long time to issue a warning about the most infamous, the most influential, the most depraved, the most disgusting man in all of human history, Paul, the founder of Christianity, the author of half of its New Testament. This warning was issued 666 years before he came on the scene. And so Yahweh was saying, you know, single individual, and these are very specific warnings that he would try to change the plan of salvation. That he would come up with a new and different covenant. And so he's saying, 666 years, that's a long time. But just because it's predicting that this lone individual, this one man, would do these things 6.5 centuries from the time that the prophecy was written down, don't think for a moment that it's not true. Now, there's very few things that God saw the need to predict, not only that far in advance, but also to tell us that this is going to come true, even though I'm predicting it way in advance. Now, he's telling us when this is going to occur. He said, it is for the moed. It is for the appointed meeting times. When is the first time in the Torah we're confronted with the word moed? It happens to be in the fourth day of creation. In the moed, it says that the sun and the moon shall be visible as signs for the moed, fourth day of creation. The greater light shall be revealed to us as part of the fourth day. Year 4000 Yah is 33 CE on our pagan calendars. It's when Yahweh honored his promise, took the very stand that he's spoken of here on our behalf and stood up for us on the moed of Pesach, Passover, on the moed of matzah, unyeasted bread, on the moed, appointed meeting time of Bukurim, firstborn children, of the moed, appointed meeting time of seven Sabbaths, Shavua. Those are the single most important fulfillments of the moed. No time in human history are the moed more important than they are in year 4000 Yah, 33 CE. That's the time that Yahweh says, this man shall come upon the scene. It was at that time that Yahusha was fulfilling these promises. Yahweh was standing up for us. That Paul was, by his own admission, in school to be a rabbi in Jerusalem. That's when he came upon the scene. Expect him in this regard. He will absolutely come, neither being delayed nor lingering. No, he was right there at that time. It's very precise. Pay attention. He will be puffed up with false pride. His soul is not right nor straightforward in him. When we return, we will consider Paul, the man who said he was so egotistical that he had to be demon-possessed to keep his ego in check. And that's the first characteristic we find about this man. Yahweh says, pay attention. Henna, behold, he will be puffed up pride. One of the things that permeates all of Paul's letters is his ego. He's ready to announce it. He even talks about how in his second letter to the Corinthians that Satan had to demon-possess him to put a sharp goad, a thorn in his side, just to control his ego. Man, if there was a characteristic most fitting for Paul, a single characteristic, you say, what is the one thing that distinguishes him more than anything else? It would be arrogance. And, you know, we've already learned from Yahweh's Torah depiction of how we test whether or not someone spoke for him or not, that arrogance was the first clue. That if a person is arrogant, they're not speaking for him. Paul was over-the-top arrogant, and that's what's being said here. Pay attention, he'll be puffed up with pride. His head will swell, and he will be haughty and arrogant. He will be lifted up for being boldly presumptuous, heedless of the truth. Now, the second thing that anyone who is really informed, if you're informed and open-minded and rational, the next thing you're going to realize is that Paul's uses circular reason, that he violates every form of logic, that his rhetoric is irrational. I mean, Pauline doctrine is irrational. Paul's letters are illogical. Circular reasoning. And so the next is his soul. It's not right nor straightforward. You know, when Paul in his letter to the Romans speaks of the Torah and the woman whose husband has died and she's a slave to the Torah, and then Paul says, you know, I would not have known that I was a repulsive libertine, that I was perverted, had it not been from the Torah. In fact, the Torah made me sexually perverted. That whole argument that he brings in the seventh chapter of Romans has got to be the dumbest exercise in flawed circular reasoning that you'll ever see. When you recognize that in the 13th chapter of Romans, that Paul speaks about how God established the government. He's writing to the Romans, so it'd be the Roman government, and that government was his government, and that it was for your good, and that you should acquiesce to them, you should surrender to them, submit to the government of Rome, which God calls the beast, says the most despicable beast in all of the human experience. He's showing that his soul, it's not right. There's something deeply troubled about this man. He's demonic. That's the bottom line here. He does not consider anything appropriately and is circuitous. He is in his reasoning. He wanders away by twisting and convoluting the teaching. When Paul takes something that Yahweh has said out of context and then misquotes him for the purpose of trying to prove that his doctrine, which is the antithesis of what Yahweh said, is actually affirmed by God, it is a perfect example of this. And that is the basis of Galatians. Galatians takes something that God has said out of context, and then it misquotes it to give the impression that God agrees with Paul, when in fact God's statement is the antithesis of Paul's claim. So then, he says, through trust and reliance, those who are righteous and vindicated shall live. Paul not once but twice quotes this line out of context. Here is this condemnation of him personally as an individual, his ego, his twisting of Yahweh's and convoluting of Yahweh's teaching. And then it says, it is through trust and reliance that those who are righteous and vindicated shall live. Paul twice quoted this to infer that it is by faith that one lives. What God is doing here is saying, listen, I'm telling you, I'm going to stand on my requirements and my responsibilities. They're going to endure forever. And so it is by knowing what I have required, knowing what I have committed to do, that you will be able to trust me and rely on what I've offered. And so it is through trust and reliance, which requires you to know what I have said, to understand what I am offering, that you will be vindicated in accordance with the means that Yahweh has already established in his Torah. That's how we live. In the context of us telling us that he is going to take his stand, that he's going to establish himself, that he's going to be firm in his requirements. The requirements are the five requirements for participation in the covenant. And upon his responsibilities, that's the role that he personally plays in fulfilling the covenant's benefits by honoring his responsibilities associated with the moed. And so in association with those moed, he says, I'm going to do what I promised. And therefore, he says, through trust and reliance, by being firmly established, confirmed, and held upright, then those who are vindicated, tzedak, righteous, shall live. Is one of the terms and conditions of the covenant. In fact, let's consider number 2 and 3 of the requirements of the covenant. Yahweh says, trust and rely on me. Being reemphasized here. It's one of the requirements on the covenant. Trust and rely on Yahweh. Now, trust and reliance requires knowledge. That's why number 4 says that Yahweh's mercy is for those who observe the terms and conditions of the covenant. In fact, observing, closely examining, carefully considering the requirements of the covenant is the fourth requirement for participation. Because you can't trust and rely on something you don't know. And the only way to know is to closely examine and carefully consider. But it's number three, which says, and walk to me and become perfect. The means to vindication, to righteousness, to perfection, tzedak, is through trust and reliance. That's why trust and reliance precedes walk to me and become perfect. Yahweh is delineating here the requirements of the covenant. And it is by acknowledging and responding to the requirements of the covenant that you're vindicated. That's what this conveys in context. Through trust and reliance, those who are righteous and vindicated shall live. It is by coming to know, responding to, accepting the requirements, the terms and conditions of the covenant, that we are vindicated and live. It's not going to change. The responsibilities, the requirements of the covenant are the same as they were with Abraham, the same as they were with David, the same as they were when Yahusha was here. They are the same now as they were then. They were forever. And these very requirements, these conditions of the covenant, these promises from Yahweh that we trust and rely upon if we wish to be vindicated and live. It's only the covenant's children who are made righteous and innocent and who are acquitted and who live as a result. So, if you look at what Paul wrote, he said, and this is Galatians 3:11, because with regard to the Torah, absolutely no one is vindicated or justified, made righteous by God, becomes evident because those who are vindicated, justified, and righteous out of faith will live. So Paul claims that with regard to the Torah, absolutely no one is vindicated. When God is saying that is the very source of vindication. And then he says proof of this is those who are vindicated, justified, and righteous out of faith will live. There's no reference to faith here. Emunah means being firmly established, confirmed, and upheld by that which is dependable and steadfast through truth, which is reliable. Emunah speaks of trust and reliance, not of faith. I don't even know if there is a Hebrew word for faith. And there's no Hebrew word for religion. There's no Hebrew word for obey. Very interesting insights as it relates to what Yahweh was telling us. Yahweh's Torah is teaching so that we might come to know and understand. It is guidance that we might follow. Think of just how stupid it is to say that those who are vindicated and righteous out of faith will live when this says, so then, through trust and reliance, those who are righteous and vindicated shall live. And then Paul takes this positive, reinforcing what he has said, out of context to infer that it's the Torah that cannot save. When there is in context, Yahweh's testimony is saying exactly the opposite. That because God is unchanging, because God's not going to renege on his responsibilities, nor change his requirements, that as a result, it is by those that you'll be saved, that you'll be vindicated. Paul is saying, no, it's actually, this statement is the opposite of that. It's saying that, nope, it's only through faith. And he wants you to believe that faith in something he never specifies is somehow proves that the Torah can't save. What's the correlation? I mean, that's like saying that red wagons are really slow. So it is by blue bicycles that you run really fast. Well, whether or not red wagons are fast or slow is irrelevant when compared to blue bicycles. There's no correlation between them. There is no correlation between, but with regard to the Torah, absolutely no one is vindicated and justified by God becomes evident because those who are vindicated out of faith will live. Red wagons versus blue bicycles. A blue bicycle might be fast, but it doesn't demonstrate that a red wagon is slow. Paul's statement is irrational. And of course, what it actually is doing is it's taking a statement that God made that affirms the enduring nature of His Torah guidance, and it tries to give the impression that God is negating it when He's affirming it. That's why Paul is so deadly. That's why he's such a despicable piece of scum. Paul also tried to quote, misquoting this statement in his letter to the Romans. For in it the righteousness of God is revealed from belief to belief, because it is written, but the righteous shall live by belief. Belief. Belief in what? And why would God even bother teaching us? Why would God bother revealing Himself to us? Why would God bother to give us the Torah, prophets, and Psalms if we can disregard it all and simply believe something nebulous? You know, I believe that the mountain I see before me is really fairy dust. When all I have to do is walk up to the mountain, kick it a few times, put my hands down in it and find out, no, it's comprised of rock. It's all there so that we can closely examine and carefully consider, come to know and understand, and therefore respond intelligently. And yet, Paul wants to discard all of that and say, ignore it all. No longer matters. It was a waste of time. It can't save you. Therefore, since that God was incompetent and His plan was unable to perform, just a complete, impotent rant by a now useless deity, all you got to do now is believe. Believe what? Believe Paul? Believe this man that can't put together a cogent argument? A man that's this ignorant, this irrational, this prone to twisting and convoluting? God would go on to say the following. Moreover, because the intoxicating wine and inebriating spirit of the man of deceptive infidelity and treacherous betrayal is a high-minded moral failure, he does not rest, find peace, nor live, whomever is open to the broad path associated with Shaul. He and his soul are like the plague of death. It's hard to imagine a proclamation any more direct, any more blunt, any more specific than this one. A man named Shaul, arising at the time that the Moed are being fulfilled, who has an inebriating spirit, who seeks to negate what God has said, who is betraying God, who is egotistical, who uses circular reasoning, who claims to be high-minded, but in fact is a moral failure, creating a system by which people believe. And God is saying, no. There will be no peace. There will be no life in what He has to say. All of those who believe Him will die. Whoever is open to the broad path, the wide, the greedy, the opportunistic, the duplicitous and improper way. Yosha would communicate even more on this. He would call the broad way, the popular path of religion, particularly Pauline Christianity, destructive and deadly. He says that all who follow that broad path will be destroyed. They'll die. That's what he's affirming here. Christianity is the most popular religion of all time. It is the broad path that leads to death and destruction, something Yosha affirmed that Yahweh is saying now 666 years in advance. Christianity is the most popular religion in all of human history. And God is saying no one that believes it will find life. No one will find peace. No one will find rest. That means, folks, that 100% of Christians are excluded from heaven. There isn't a single Pauline Christian in heaven. Not one. You have God's word on it. Because of the inebriating spirit. Who's the inebriating spirit? Satan. Of the man of deceptive infidelity. Now, it's not just that Paul claimed that he had a different concept of salvation, that salvation through faith in the gospel of grace, that his interpretation of things was the only means to salvation. All other means had to be condemned. It's not just that he said those things. He actually demeaned Yahweh, demeaned his Torah, denounced his Torah, while claiming that he was inspired by the very God who authored the Torah, which makes it not just deceptive, but also an act of infidelity. So these are two very appropriate terms, deceptive infidelity and treacherous betrayal. Now, if you're an idiot out there and you said, you know, I've got a plan of salvation, and the plan of salvation is that we're going to mock China, we're going to mock Russia, and we're going to become completely reliant on purchasing oil from those who are plotting to kill us and who hate us while not developing our own energy capability, and we're going to bankrupt ourselves by lavishing entitlements on people who don't work for them and destroying their character in the process.
Who is Barack Obama?
Yeah, who is Barack Obama? Okay, that's the answer. So you can go off and say those kind of things. If you say those kind of things, you're not guilty of deceptive infidelity. You're not guilty of treacherous betrayal. What you're saying is wrong. What you're saying will fail. But you're not, if you go and say that Yahweh's Torah, prophets and Psalms, is entirely false, and that there is no way to find truth or salvation in them, and that Yahweh's means to liberate is actually a means to enslave, he's a really tricky God, and that I have a plan, and not only do I have a plan, but God himself has acquiesced to my plan. He is God's agreeing that it's appropriate for me to renounce him and to advocate a new plan that completely contradicts his old plan. Now, if you make that kind of claim, which is what Paul does in his letters, then you're guilty of deceptive infidelity. Then it's treacherous betrayal. Then when you claim that you're smarter than everybody else, that you alone are the appointed person who is completing what God failed to do, and that you should ignore what everybody else says. In fact, if somebody else has a different plan, they're to be condemned, and then you permeate your writings with, "But I say," then you're a high-minded moral failure. And you're particularly a moral failure when you admit that you're sexually perverted, which he does in Romans, and repulsive in terms of being vicious and murderous, which he does in Galatians. Then God is going beyond that and saying, this man of deceptive infidelity, he is going to create a broad path, a religion, a very popular religion. But you need to know that that broad path, that very popular religion that he's going to create, that no one will live who believes him. No one will find rest. No one will find any peace. There will be no reconciliation. There will be no salvation. There will be no invitation into heaven. There will be no eternal life attributable to his broad and popular path. And then God goes all the way to say, oh, by the way, just in case you haven't figured it out, the man's name is Shaul. The man's name is Shaul. Now, I want you to tell me, someone other than Paul, who admits that his name was Shaul, he claims that the flashing light on the road to Damascus called him Shaul, 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 that this man born as Shaul, I want you to tell me how many Shauls appeared at the time that the Moed were being fulfilled in Jerusalem that were aggressively egotistical, who used circular reasoning, who were deceptive and treacherous, who created a path so popular it became the world's most popular religion. They were named Shaul. Why don't you come up with a list and maybe at tomorrow's show, those of you who are still a Christian can call in and provide a alternative to Paul, the author of half of the Christian New Testament. There isn't any. We'll be back tomorrow.